it's Diane. On my mind, Congress averted an economic disaster this week by raising the debt ceiling. But for Norman Ornstein, how it played out has become Exhibit A in demonstrating our legislative body's dysfunction. Ornstein is one of the country's foremost experts on Congress. He ticks off numerous examples to make the case that in today's political climate, reforms are needed now. Executive and judicial appointments are blocked, bipartisan bills shelved, an investigation into the violent insurrection of January 6th impeded. Ornstein lays blame at the feet of Republicans who, he argues, seem more interested in power than governing. But he also points to the rules of the institution that make obstruction easy. Norman Ornstein joined me Friday morning to explain why it doesn't have to be this way. Norm, I want to start with questions about the debt limit. Where are we and why has this become such a huge issue this year?
The fact is we're practically speaking the only country that does this, that has votes on the limit of the debt that we've incurred. And for many decades, we saw political games played where the party that didn't have the presidency would pose as the protectors of the fisc. But it was always seen by both sides as a game where if there were ever a threat, a real threat to breach the debt ceiling, which means you're endangering the full faith and credit of the United States and the consequences, especially because the dollar is the world's currency, would be catastrophic, that the votes would be there. If one party didn't have, the party of the president didn't have enough votes, the other party always made it clear they'd provide enough votes to keep that from happening. The fact is that as we move especially into the Obama presidency, and as we saw the Republican Party become more radical and more willing to take us over the cliff or move us right to the edge of the cliff as a way of taking things like the debt limit as a hostage, we saw change. And in 2009, 2010, 2011, and remember in 2010, after the Republicans with the Tea Party wave took the majority in the House of Representatives, you had a lot of members who were willing to force us over the cliff to get Barack Obama to, you know, do what they wanted. And we had the former representative Jason Chaffetz say, yeah, we were serious. We would have done this. Now, the leaders at the time, including Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, knew that you couldn't push too far or they would suffer the consequences being in the majority. So in 2011, McConnell came up with a unique way to get out of this dilemma where he knew most of his members weren't going to go along, but it was, we'll let the president unilaterally raise the debt ceiling and Congress can pass a joint resolution blocking it so his members could all vote to block it, but the president could veto it and then all he would need is one third plus one of the members of one house. That became known informally as the McConnell rule, but it was used only once. And we should add that after the Republicans took the majority in 2010, when Mitch McConnell was asked about this, he said, the debt ceiling is a hostage worth taking. So this time, McConnell pushed it very close to the limit. And when what he wanted to do, to be frank, is he wanted the Democrats to do this alone, but not just to do it in a simple resolution. When they brought up a simple, straightforward, we're going to raise the debt ceiling, the Republicans in the Senate filibustered. So even though he said, we're not going to provide the help, and remember, this is basically to raise the ceiling so that we can guarantee the $8 to $9 trillion in debt rung up during the Trump administration. But he didn't just say, we'll just stand aside. They filibustered it, meaning it was impossible to raise the debt ceiling. They wanted Chuck Schumer to do this through this budget process of reconciliation. And the reason that he wanted them to do it this way is because they'd be forced to act on a timetable so that they couldn't do their big Build Back Better plan, and that it would take a lot of additional time and a number of hoops to jump through. Finally, when it became clear that Schumer wasn't going to do that, they gave a two-month extension. Now we have until December, and there are some serious questions at this point for Democrats to ask. And if I had my druthers, if I had my way, I would say use reconciliation, but don't just raise the debt ceiling so that we have to go through this again next year and the following year. And it's a ridiculous process. At some point, we're going to falter and it'll be catastrophic. And so what I would do is I would make permanent that so-called McConnell rule. Or if we don't do that, there's another way, something that was done in the House for a couple of years at the instigation of the majority leader, Steny Hoyer, back then, which is in the budget resolution that you pass, you just automatically increase the debt ceiling to fit what's there in the budget. There are two ways to do this, but if they just raise the debt ceiling a little bit, they're making a big mistake.
Now, hasn't McConnell been criticized by many of his own members for even extending it to December?
You know, it's a measure of where Republicans are that a large share of the Republicans in the Senate are more than willing to have the country go over the cliff. And, you know, a part of the reason for this, and maybe the largest part of the reason for this, is a belief that even if they've brought it about, the public will always blame the party in power, the party of the president. And the press corps, frankly, will play it that way as well. And that heading into that midterm election where they're most intent on winning back the majority in the Senate, and they hope in the House, that it would work to their advantage. And of course, the other part of it is that if Joe Biden has to deal with the fallout, which, you know, economists have suggested could mean 6 million jobs lost, 9% unemployment, and a deep recession, then none of the rest of his program that he wants to enact, including the democracy reforms, including this big, ambitious Build Back Better plan with child tax credits, child care, free community college and pre-K and so on, and climate change initiatives, will be enacted. It's mind-boggling.
And that's exactly why Mitch McConnell is doing this.
Yes, Mitch McConnell is... You know, in the past, I've defined him as a ruthless pragmatist, ruthless being the most important part. He has a goal. Right now, the goal is to win the majority in the Senate. And how do you do that? You make the administration, the Democrats, and all of their voters get demoralized and not turn out, and you increase the anger level in your own party's base. And of course, while Republicans have many more seats up in the Senate in 2022, a lot of them are in red states. And if they can get their red voters out, and that means the working class white voters and an awful lot of Hispanic voters, and depress the turnout of the college educated voters, he'll accomplish that goal. But, you know, the price that Americans have to pay is a secondary concern. And if you look at what's happening with all these people dying from COVID in states where reckless governors like Greg Abbott in Texas and Ron DeSantis in Florida and so many more in states like Oklahoma and Idaho and South Dakota, Kristi Noem being among the worst, and Missouri, Mike Parsons, are fighting mask mandates, vaccination, and seeing the consequences with people dying, that they, you know, I don't think they're losing a minute's sleep over that.
Now, the other question here is in regard to the filibuster and to what extent somehow doing away with the filibuster could have avoided all this.
If the filibuster rule had been changed, we would be in a different place. But the caveat here, Democrats have exactly 50 of the 100 senators. There is not going to be a single Republican vote for any Biden or Democratic initiative. One good example, in 2006, the last time the Voting Rights Act was extended, before it was blown up by the Shelby County decision in the Supreme Court, it was passed unanimously in the Senate. The co-sponsors included Mitch McConnell and Chuck Grassley, among many others. Not one of them supports the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, which is simply trying to restore what they all voted for 15 years ago. They now are the party of no for anything that would endanger, even if it's good for the country and democracy, their status as a minority party able to win elections. So Democrats can't count on any of them. They have to get all 50. And getting all 50 is a challenge. Now, all 50 are supporting the package Freedom to Vote, as it's called, the revision of the H.R. 1 and S.1 bill that includes a panoply of things to change campaign finance, make it easier to vote, and move the election to a holiday, and to basically protect against partisans being able to fire election officials at will and intimidate poll workers and alter the results of elections because they've lost them. That's really important. But if you don't alter the filibuster rule, that goes nowhere. And I would say flatly, I don't want to be an alarmist, if we don't get this package of voting reforms through, I think our democracy is going to be gone. It's on life support now with what's happening in a lot of states. Now, you know, we're not going to eliminate the filibuster. There aren't 50 Democratic votes to do that. And there are ways in the rules. We've seen this before with alterations in the filibuster rule, Rule 22. But there are proposals out there that would alter it in a fundamental way. I've had one for 10 years that I've done in conjunction with Al Franken from when he was in the Senate that is pretty simple. And it's designed to, I would argue, restore the filibuster to what it was originally over many decades, which is something where the burden is on a minority that feels intensely about something and not on the majority. Right now, you need all 60 votes, 60 of 100 votes to stop debate and move towards action. I would flip that around and say 41 votes are needed to continue debate. And if you combine that with the idea of Senator Jeff Merkley, the talking filibuster, where you've got to have 41 on the floor at all times while you're debating it, and they have to debate germanely, meaning they can't just read Green Eggs and Ham. Right. They have to talk right. about the issue at hand. And you can go round the clock and have them have to be there at 4 in the morning, and you have to be there on the weekends, and you can schedule a vote so that they're going to have to scramble back. If you do that, you have more than a fighting chance of being able to get some of these things done. And I think we've got a chance of getting Democrats to support that, but I don't know when. I'm hoping it'll happen after we get these votes next week on the Freedom to Vote Act, and they're filibustered.
And Norm, what do you expect to happen in December about raising that debt limit different from what's happened thus far?
If the Democrats do not act through the reconciliation process to alter this dynamic, or not as good but still doable, just simply raise the debt ceiling through reconciliation, which they don't want to do, but I don't think they have an alternative. If this comes up again, just as a simple, straightforward vote in December, I am very, very fearful that the Republicans will block it. They can call for a filibuster at any time. Even if McConnell wanted to make this happen, he's going to have to control most of his members. And remember that when they did this vote and McConnell said, let's just kick it to December, they've got barely over the 10 they needed to make it happen. And several of them have said they won't do it again. So we're playing Russian roulette with the economy and the well-being of Americans. And it is all the doing of a Republican Party that it cares about one thing, which is seizing power however they can.
And to what extent is Donald Trump spurring them on?
You know, in many ways, it's interesting, Diane. There's a growing frustration among Republicans who want to win elections with Trump, who is basically saying, if you don't put me back in the White House and relitigate 2020, then you should just stay home, which is the last thing that they want to hear. And you see now some of his most ardent supporters trying to get him to hush up about that, which isn't going to work. But let's face it, the reality that we have here is that Trump still commands the allegiance of the overwhelming majority of Republicans in the country. And we had, just as a good example, one of the most cringeworthy and embarrassing things that I've seen in the last few months, which is a rally that Trump held in Iowa. And Charles Grassley appeared on the stage with Donald Trump as he spouted his pathetic lies about the election being stolen and about January 6th being this wonderful event where citizens came to Washington to preserve our country. And then Grassley eagerly accepted Trump's endorsement for his reelection campaign. And what Grassley said was, I wasn't born yesterday. 90% of the Republicans in this state support Trump. So, of course, I'm going to accept his endorsement. The idea that you have a moral core, that there are limits to how far you will go to undermine the fundamental democracy in the country or endanger voters, that the most senior people, people who are not, you know, looking for anything one would think other than their legacy in public service, would demean themselves this way. And it's hard for me to find a single Republican who isn't close to that in the way they've acted in the House and Senate, with just the two exceptions in the House, the shining exceptions, Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger. A few others who voted for impeachment after Trump incited the violent insurrection, who are retiring because they can't take it anymore. But, you know, what we've seen is a complete collapse of moral clarity and of fundamental values in a party that's become a cult. I wish I could be less brutal in my judgment. I wish I could be more balanced, but we're not in a balanced time.
What about Democrats who are not adhering to the president's desires, people like Joe Manchin, Kristen Sinema? What is going on? I mean, Joe Manchin keeps changing the line. Every time he gets what he wants, there seems to be some other goal in mind.
You know, it's frustrating in part because we're at a moment of urgency. First of all, if you only have 50 of the 100 senators, and if you have a margin of only 3 in the House, at any moment you could lose that majority and then nothing will happen, including getting judges confirmed, getting your executive nominees. We still don't have, for example, anybody nominated to be the chair of the Federal Communications Commission. And it could go to a Republican majority at the end of the year if they don't move on this. But what we also know is, with this critical election for governor in Virginia coming up next month, if what we see is continued gridlock, Democrats will be demoralized, and we could get Glenn Youngkin, a Republican who's trying to campaign as a reasonable person, but who is an all-in Trumpist, elected. And that could have its implications in 2024.
Why is that election so close, Norm?
There are a couple of reasons for it, Diane. The fundamental reason is, and we see this happening frequently, once a party is in power, its own adherents don't have a sense of urgency themselves. They think things will happen, and when they don't happen, and, you know, rarely do we get dramatic action on everything early on, their urgency to vote goes down, and it's an, you know, not just a midterm election, it's an off-year election. And the adherents of the other party get more charged up. Now, what's also the case is a deeper problem that Democrats have to face, which is the expectation that because of the nativist positions of Donald Trump and the Republicans, of Stephen Miller and others, that Hispanic voters would flock to Democrats, has not proven to be the case. And what surveys show is that the Hispanics in Northern Virginia, a very important force, are not going to be voting Democratic in overwhelming numbers. They'll still be a majority, but this is not just the Cuban Americans in Florida or the, you know, Hispanics, the Mexican Americans in the Rio Grande Valley, whose families have been there for 150 years, who consider themselves to be white and not brown. It's a broader problem. But along with that, Glenn Youngkin, who is one of the founders of the Carlyle Group, is a billionaire, has said he'd be willing to spend $100 million on this campaign, has run a whole series of commercials, very slickly done, that makes him seem to be a reasonable guy. Now, the biggest issue that's motivating the voters that is making a difference here is schools. And a part of it is, after COVID has created all this disruption in people's lives and not knowing whether your kids are going to be back in school, not knowing how to juggle when your kids are home or at school, what Youngkin has done is to say he's with the parents, and that's getting some emotional reaction. And so it's close. I think you can see from what McAuliffe has said, Terry McAuliffe, the Democratic candidate, the former governor, what senators like Mark Warner of Virginia have said, get this infrastructure package done before the election so we've got something to run on, a victory to run on. There's a nervousness there, and you would hope that Sinema and Manchin would understand that. You would also hope, you know, the compromise, the Freedom to Vote Act, was put together by Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota and Joe Manchin fundamentally, and it's Manchin's plan, and he's been going out trying to get 10 Republicans because he believes that the filibuster encourages bipartisan support. He has not won. So one would hope he would then say, well, we're going to have to do something with the filibuster. With Sinema, she's a little bit more of a cipher here. But, you know, as people have criticized them up and down, what I've had to remind people is if that Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, however much you are frustrated with them now, provided the votes to get the American Rescue Package, $1.9 trillion, including provisions that cut child poverty in half. They voted to make Chuck Schumer the majority leader instead of Mitch McConnell, to have Democrats chairing all the committees for almost all of the nominees who've gone forward. And if you push too far and one of them becomes an independent and caucuses with the Republicans or becomes a Republican, all that is gone. So they know they have leverage. And if you've only got 50, every one has leverage, but 48 know that they better hang together to, because this is their chance to enact significant things and to keep their majority. And one would just hope that over the next couple of weeks, we get some movement. That movement is not going to be the full package of dramatic reforms in human infrastructure that President Biden ran on, but it could still be dramatic.
A quick break. When we come back, the rest of my conversation with Norman Ornstein.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Norman Ornstein. He's emeritus scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Now, you know, every person I've talked to, Democrats, Republicans, seems to blame everything on Joe Biden. Joe Biden has made mistakes. He's not doing enough. He's not out there pushing enough. Yesterday, he had an announcement about the issue of the court. He took no questions. What's going on with Joe Biden?
Well, first, let me come to his defense a little bit. He's facing extraordinary headwinds in the political process, including this very close majority. He's trying to cope with a continuing pandemic where his ability to act is limited because of the radical governors and state legislatures around the country who are keeping us from getting to that threshold of vaccination that we wouldn't have to worry about it, and who are super spreaders in effect. So there are some limits there. And there are limits to what you can do to push Congress. And you're always going to face, you know, if you're the president, people are going to blame you for whatever happens. Gasoline prices are going up. It's a global phenomenon of energy shortages.
The food prices going up.
Food prices because the supply chains and the, you know, we have a shortage of chips, and there are all kinds of reasons for that, most of which are unrelated to action by a president. But having said that, what I haven't seen from not just the White House, but from the Congress, is this sense of urgency. We have so many key positions in the executive branch that don't even have nominees yet. Now, some of that is because they're going to have to be sure they've got 50 Democrats on board, but they should have been moving at a much faster clip. The Senate should have been around on weekends and Mondays and Fridays because, you know, when they changed the filibuster rule, lowering the threshold to 50 for nominations for courts and executive positions, that didn't eliminate the filibuster, which can soak up a lot of time on every individual confirmation. It just meant you could block it with 50. But you still have to go through a bunch of hoops, and each individual one takes a lot of precious floor time. And, of course, we have two senators, Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley, who are undermining American national security by trying to block every nominee for the Defense Department, the State Department, the intelligence community. It's shocking, but it's also causing delays. But we need more of a sense of urgency there and more commitments to push things through. My criticism, if I had any, of the way that the administration and the president have handled the infrastructure package and the Build Back Better Act is that I wish a few months ago he had been going around the country and focusing on individual components. Go to Ohio, a critical battleground state in 2022. Go outside of Youngstown or Akron and talk about free community college as a way of training people for jobs that'll be there in a global economy. You know, go outside of Cincinnati and talk about free pre-K, which means that we're going to get young people when they need it most to be ready to thrive as adults, and we're going to enable people to work better. I wish he had done more of that.
So
but
he's not
the big problem here.
But the question is, why isn't he doing the kinds of things you're suggesting? People barely see him. Why isn't he out there campaigning as though the world is coming to an end?
I don't have a good answer to that, Diane. I think they're trying to manage the conflict as best they can, and they're taking a gamble here, and to some degree I can understand it. And the gamble is this. If they get, let's say, a $2 trillion Build Back Better package, and it may not include all of the individual components, I'd prefer that they include them all for a shorter period of time. But let's say you get that with a continued child tax credit, which again, reduced child poverty by 50%, did more in one step than all of the war on poverty did from the 1960s on. And you get a child care provision so that you can have two parents in a household able to work and actually bring in more money. Right now, if you have a second parent working, the child care cost can be as much as that parent will earn out there on the marketplace.
No, what you're saying is that he's holding back, or the administration has decided to hold him back so as not to ruffle too many feathers.
And what I'm saying is that if we get that plus the $1 trillion in the physical infrastructure bill, $3 trillion, along with the almost $2 trillion in the rescue plan. We're okay. In great society territory in terms of dramatic accomplishments, and the great society had super majorities of Democrats in both houses. So that would be an immense accomplishment. And if we can segue then to the democracy reforms, we're talking about historic action. Now, was this the best way to do it? It's not the way I would have done it, but we're going to find out soon enough if they made a big mistake. Still, I'd like to see him out there more, and I'd like to see the vice president out there more.
Now, what has happened to Kamala Harris?
I'm puzzled in a couple of ways. Biden gave her two major portfolios, the border and the immigration issue, not an easy one to deal with, and it's never going to be easy, and the democracy package. And I'm not sure why we haven't seen a lot of visible action on her part to show that as the spearhead here, she's grappling with them. Why they haven't, for example, done, you know, we have a summit coming up in December on the challenges to democracy globally, a lot of different countries coming in. I would have loved to have seen Kamala Harris chairing a summit on the challenge to democracy in America, bringing in all kinds of experts about why this freedom to vote package is absolutely essential, or we could lose something that's been the most precious element in the country since its founding. I'm just not sure why.
Are the advisors around Joe Biden and Kamala Harris giving them good advice?
I will say that when I look at the team of the top people around the president, from Ron Klain, the chief of staff, to Steve Ricchetti, the kind of chief negotiator now on this infrastructure package, and Louisa Terrell, who's heading up his congressional liaison, and a series of other advisors, it's the A-team. It's a group of seasoned professionals who know what they're doing and who command respect. Why they're not doing it the way I would want to do it is another story. But in the end, we're just going to have to see whether the approach that they've taken, and, you know, there are limits to what you want the president out there, but you don't want at a time of tribalism to make this all about Joe Biden, or you run into your own risks, including with some of your own members in challenging districts. But it's still the one bully pulpit that is the most significant in the country is that of the president of the United States. And what we know with presidents as well is even if you don't get the national press attention when you go out somewhere, the local press covers you in a big way. So, you know, now he's going to go out to try and sell the Build Back Better package. I just wish he'd done that 2 months ago.
Exactly. And polls show that a majority of Americans support these spending bills. So it would seem he's got an easy sell with the people themselves.
It's interesting, Diane. Chris Saliza, who's now with CNN, did a post yesterday saying Biden's in big trouble because the polls show that the numbers have dropped in terms of whether Americans want government to be more active in their lives. And I wrote him and said, Chris, you're missing the key element here, which is every single component of this package gets 70 to 80% support from Americans. So
exactly.
If they say we don't want government to do as much in our lives, but boy, give us those checks, give us the child care, give us the free community college, give us the free early childhood education, give us the climate change measures and green energy. That's the most important thing. And what you need to do with this package, and, you know, he's been hurt by a press corps that has focused incessantly on the number, $3.5 trillion, is it going to be $2 trillion, is it going to be $1.5 trillion? What you want to do is parse it out. And what I'll tell you one other thing, if I had been the majority leader of the Senate, I would have done before now, is I would have brought each of those components up for a separate debate and vote in the Senate. Let the Republicans filibuster, child tax credits, which they had long supported. Let them filibuster free community college and some of these other plans. And then you're going to get more momentum for a change in the filibuster rule, but you're also going to have them directly on record, not as they now are, as saying, we don't want all this government spending, but why they're against things that are wildly popular, including among Republicans.
Another question is Biden himself doing enough within his own party to shore up support for his programs?
So I do think what we've seen is the president has spent an extraordinary amount of time with groups of members of Congress and individual members, including with Senators Sinema and Manchin, trying to move the needle to get an agreement on a package. I gather that's been frustrating because it's been hard to get the two of them to yes. But he's doing that. And he's also, I think, providing a good deal of cover for the different groups of members who are nervous about 2022. That includes a lot of those moderates who are the ones in the most vulnerable districts. But he's also, remember, been able to keep those progressives in the most pragmatic place in terms of understanding that they're not going to get what they wanted, and they may not even get half of what they wanted. But they understand that it's in his interest and their interest to get this done now, or it might never get done at all. So I'll give him credit there. I also think that while, you know, you're going to find Republicans around the country in this tribal era who will never accept the legitimacy of a Joe Biden. We have 70% of Republicans who still think he's not a legitimate president. But for voters in the middle, including suburban Republican and independent voters, where Biden said he wants to bring people together, that's probably helping. And that's critical for a lot of these House and Senate races, but it's also critical if we're ever to get past this corrosive, horrible position we're in as a country where we are so deeply divided and where violence is around the corner if we're not careful.
Do you expect Donald Trump to run again in 2024?
I'm still a little skeptical, Diane. I think he will insist he's going to run because he pulls in enormous sums of money. And, you know,
what's he doing with that money?
Well, he can use it for almost anything he wants. So he's going to use it for his lifestyle at this point. Now, we've still got legal actions ahead, including in the state of New York. I'm a little skeptical that he'll run. But having said that, we are dealing with a lifelong narcissistic sociopath verging on psychopath who is caught up in these fantasies about what happened in 2020 and not only looking for revenge, but I think the single largest motivator for him to run and hope to win is so that he can avoid all the legal problems, including for his own companies, that he faces otherwise. And so my skepticism about his running is tempered a little bit by the fact that he may need to do it in order to avoid either jail or complete loss of his Trump enterprises.
One more question. What about these fellows who have refused to come forward to testify about January 6th, having refused a subpoena? Will they go to jail? Will they face huge fines? What's going to happen?
What I'd love to see, frankly, is the sergeant at arms pick them up and throw them in a cell in the basement of the Capitol until they're willing to testify. I do think there's determination on the part of every member of the Select Committee, including Cheney and Kinsinger. We've seen Jamie Raskin and Adam Schiff out there, Benny Thompson as well, saying they're not going to let them get away with this. Now, it's a long and difficult process to push for criminal contempt of Congress. It will have to go to trial. And, you know, we have to remember that at a jury trial, all it'll take is one Trump adherent to cause a hung jury. But Steve Bannon richly deserves to be held in criminal contempt, and so do the others. Now, I do think that faced with the prospect of contempt and faced with the prospect of huge legal bills, a lot of the people around Donald Trump, maybe not the most visible ones that we're seeing now, but ones who know what happened, who were there in the room, who saw the emails, who heard the conversations, they may not be willing to put themselves into horrible positions, and they will give a lot of information to the committee. The committee can probably get a lot from phone records and in other ways. I think we're going to see devastating things, even if these miscreants don't testify. But I would put them through the ringer because they participated in a violent insurrection against the United States, and we cannot let them get away with it or it'll happen again. And if we don't pass the Freedom to Vote Act, we could be in a position where they will try in a quasi-legal fashion to steal the next election, and then the country is gone.
Not happy talk, but always good to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Diane. Always good to talk with you.
That was Norman Ornstein. He's emeritus scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and co-author of the book One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody with help from Sandra Baker. Our engineer today is Michael Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. Be well. Stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.